Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday. We're going to talk about the tornadoes that swept through so much of the country on Leap Thursday. Our guest writes in his Dr. Jeff Masters Wonder blog, a massive tornado outbreak of stunning violence swept through the nation's midsection, spawning deadly tornadoes that killed, I guess the figure is now up to 40 people. And the speed with which some of the storms moved was truly exceptional, thanks to jet stream winds up to 115 miles per hour that pushed the storms forward at amazing speeds. A number of the tornadoes ripped through Kentucky with forward speeds of 70 miles an hour. Two tornado warnings in central Kentucky were issued for apparent thunderstorms that moved at 85 miles an hour. If damage surveys reveal that these thunderstorms did indeed spawn tornadoes, they will set the record for fastest moving tornadoes in recorded history. And you have to ask the question, do we need to ask the question, are we seeing this kind of fierce weather because of climate change? Does it have anything to do with how early these storms were happening and how fierce these storms are? Joining us to talk about all of that is Jeffrey Masters. He is the director and co-founder of Meteorology Weather Underground Incorporated. He received his bachelor's and master's degrees in meteorology and participated in field programs studying acid rain in the Northeast U.S. and air pollution in the Detroit area. He taught weather forecasting to undergraduates at State University of New York, Brockport, and then moved to Miami to join the Hurricane Hunters as a flight meteorologist for the Aircraft Operations Center. You can see him on the PBS documentary Nova show titled Hurricane. After nearly getting killed flying into Hurricane Hugo, he decided that it was time to leave the Hurricane Hunters, which was, I'm sure, a wise decision. He pursued his PhD degree in air pollution meteorology from the University of Michigan and founded the Weather Underground in 1995. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jeffrey. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number, and the email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning to you. Well, it was one of those days when I don't know all that much about the weather, but I sat and watched the news reports, and my mouth was just hanging open. I couldn't believe how fierce these storms were, how many tornadoes there were, and how huge an area of the United States was affected. It was remarkable.
Yes, I was watching it as well, as you can imagine. And the size of the U.S. it covered from southern Ohio all the way down to northern Florida was truly exceptional. And the traffic we saw on our website as a result was hitting record levels because so many people were affected by this storm system.
Why was it so large?
We had a situation where the storm system just covered a big part of the country. The cold front that trailed from the low, which was over southern Michigan, went all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, and all along that front, you were getting severe weather. So I don't know why the entire front was getting severe weather. I mean, you need two ingredients to get severe weather. One is strong winds in the upper air, which we had over an exceptionally large area. And the other is a very unstable air, and it just so happened we had a big area covered by both of these things.
Jeffrey, was it unusual to have these kinds of tornadoes in early March?
Oh, absolutely. We don't often see this sort of tornado outbreak this early in the year. In fact, we've never seen a five-day period of tornadoes this large this early in the year, so very unusual.
So the obvious question is, why are we seeing it?
The obvious answer is because we had a very warm winter. You need a lot of warm air at the surface in order to get tornadoes, and that's hard to do when you've got cold winter temperatures, which certainly we saw the previous two winters. But this winter, as all of you in Wisconsin can attest to, it's been remarkably warm, 6 to 7 degrees above normal in Wisconsin, and it's also been quite warm down over the Gulf of Mexico. The ocean has heated up to near record levels, about a degree and a half Fahrenheit above normal, And when you have all that warm water down there, you can evaporate a lot of moisture into the air, and you've got a ready source of heat and moisture to help fuel tornadoes. And that's exactly what happened on Friday's tornado outbreak.
Mm-hmm. So do you, as a forecaster, anticipate that we're in for a pretty rocky early spring?
You know, I can only see into the future maybe a week or two somewhat clearly using our computer models. The atmosphere is just too chaotic to say what's going to be happening later on in March. And the close look that I have at the latest models doesn't show anything major happening this week. And I don't really know what's going to happen the rest of spring. It's too hard to tell. But having seen one terrific tornado outbreak already this year, and then last year we saw three of the top five on record going back to 1950, this certainly seems the gloves are off, and it wouldn't surprise me at all to see another pretty large tornado outbreak this spring.
Is there anything we can do to stop it?
Somebody wrote me an email yesterday saying that we should take remotely piloted aircraft filled with hydrazine and fly them into the middle of the tornadoes and detonate them to explode the tornadoes. And I told them that, well, okay, you can be the one to get close enough to the tornado to do that, and you can be the one that takes lawsuits when your hydrazine-fueled rocket explodes over some city and sets it on fire. So there's not a lot we can really do about this sort of weather phenomena. It's just too large and powerful and too dangerous, and we don't know what we're doing either. So I would say leave them alone and get in your basement is the best strategy.
Right. And what about the issue of the climate changing, Jeffrey? Do we have to ask that question? Do we know if there's a relationship between the warmer ocean that you talked about, the warmer temperatures, the lack of winter in much of the country?
It's a very good question to ask. Whenever you're getting unprecedented weather events or extreme weather events, we need to ask the question, is climate change partially responsible for this? And the answer is always, we can talk in probabilities but not certainties. We know that climate change, by increasing the temperatures at the surface, can potentially lead to tornado outbreaks, because one of the key ingredients you need is to have very warm, moist air near the surface. And certainly we had that with this tornado outbreak. We set 21 record highs at airports in the tornado outbreak region on Friday.
Really?
Yeah, and that warm, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico was partially to blame for that.
Mm.
And when you combine that warm air now with cold air aloft, you get what's called an unstable situation, where when you get an updraft rising in a thunderstorm, now it can accelerate upwards because it's less dense than its surroundings. And that helps drive tornadoes if you get strong updrafts in a thunderstorm. But it's unclear with climate change how exactly the other ingredient you need for tornadoes is going to be affected. Okay, we do expect climate change will make the atmosphere more unstable. You got more warm air near the surface. It helps drive the updrafts of the thunderstorms, generating stronger tornadoes potentially. But the other key ingredient you need is something to get that air mass spinning. And the way you get the air spinning is to have a sharp change in the wind speed with height. That's called wind shear. And during Friday's storms, we had a very, very strong jet stream. The winds, as you were reading early in the broadcast, were blowing over 115 miles per hour
Goodness.
Over the plains. And when those winds decrease sharply with height, you get a shearing motion on the air. I mean, you can envision it. If something's blowing on you really hard in one place and not very hard in the other, it's going to create a shearing force, which will make that air column spin. And that's exactly what happened in Friday's outbreak. Lots and lots of spin was imparted to the atmosphere by these strong jet stream winds. But the jet stream is expected to weaken with a warmer climate. And it's unclear how that weaker jet stream, which is going to make for less spin applied to potential tornadoes, how is that weakened jet stream going to interplay with the increase in instability? So we got one climate change effect, increasing tornadoes, one decreasing tornadoes. It's very unclear how the end result is going to play out.
Well, how do we find out? How do we find the answer to that question?
You know, it's going to be really hard to do because tornadoes are very hard to observe. We don't ever have instruments in them that can measure their winds. The only way we know how strong they were is if they happen to run over a building.
Mm.
And that's not a very scientific way to figure out how strong they are. So I really don't see any hope for scientifically being able to track changes in tornado activity just because they are so hard to observe.
Mm-hmm. And what about those record highs that you were talking about? What were those? How warm was it, and where was it warm?
Yeah, they were in the low to mid-80s.
Ooh.
That was, I think, Memphis, Tennessee hit 84, which was 4 degrees warmer than their previous record for that date. Atlanta was 78. A lot of low 80s all through Kentucky, Arkansas, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi.
Uh-huh. And then in places like Kentucky, it's going to snow today.
Well, yeah, they got up to 5 inches of snow in some of the regions that got hit by the tornado. It's the March roller coaster.
What a roller coaster. Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. Jeffrey Masters, co-founder and director of Meteorology for Weather Underground, is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. We simply had to pay attention to the weather, partially because we all talk about it all winter here. Where the heck was the winter? It showed up at the end of February. It's just been weird this winter. Nothing. No winter. And now these storms, devastating storms that just took over this whole huge part of the country. And there was amazing destruction, and people died, and it was very early in March, unusual. So you have to ask the question, what in the world is going on? And Jeffrey is providing the answers. 800-486-8655. We go to Bob in River Falls for our first call. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Yes, I had a couple of quick questions. One of them was, I looked at some satellite images on the National Weather Service site, and they have moisture. I don't really know how to interpret them that much, but it looked to me like some of the moisture was actually feeding from the Pacific Ocean all the way up into the storm, which was in Iowa. And I thought, that's got to be one of the most unusual things for a storm to be that gigantic. It was huge. Secondly, is there an index, if you include the heat index, which combines the moisture and the temperature, is there a number that you put into your formulas to figure out how strong something's likely to be between that and, like, the 20 or 30 degree air mass behind it? It's got to be one of the greatest temperature differences that you're going to see along with moisture to feed that energy in there.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. Absolutely. As far as your second question goes, we have various indexes that track the instability of the air based on the temperature and the moisture like you're talking about, and they were pretty high. I mean, we were seeing values, they expressed it in joules per kilogram, and they were up around 2,000, which is very high. Not quite as high as we saw during some of the outbreaks last year, but nevertheless, record levels for this early in the year, early March. You don't often see air that unstable. And it was a huge system. As you're saying, most of the moisture did come from the Gulf of Mexico, but I think you're correct. It was tapping some moisture from the Pacific as well. You don't often see that in a storm system.
Anything else, Bob? No, Bob is gone. All right, thanks for the call. Ray in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, growing up in Milwaukee public schools, we were taught about every 10,000 years the Earth goes into this cycle where you have small ice ages, and about 10,000 years ago was the last one, and if it's a cyclic period, what do you believe that global warming is going to prevent the next small ice age? Since they come about every 10,000 years, we should be heading back in to whatever caused the last one. And what does the guest think caused the Earth to warm 10,000 years ago and get rid of the last ice age when the ice cap was a mile and a half over the city of Chicago?
Jeffrey.
Yeah, great questions. We do understand what causes ice ages. The Earth's orbit is not perfectly circular. It changes. It's got a number of different motions that affect the amount of sunlight falling on the Earth, and in particular, the amount of sunlight falling on the North Pole. And that's critical for determining the amount of ice the planet has. If you put more sunshine on the North Pole, it tends to warm up and melt the ice there and end an ice age. And that's exactly what happened about 10,000 years ago. It turned out that the north pole of the planet started getting more sunshine just because the orientation of the Earth's orbit was putting the North Pole towards the sun more in summer than it used to be. So the ice cap started to melt. Also, there's a couple other variations in the Earth's orbit. It's elliptical, and sometimes we're closer to the sun than other times, and that changes the amount of sun. And there's also the tilt of the Earth's axis changes. Right now it's 23 degrees, and it oscillates between somewhere around 22 and a half and 24 degrees. And that all these things affect the amount of sun the Earth gets and the distribution of it, and will trigger ice ages or cause them to end. And you're absolutely right. We are expecting another ice age. Scientists argue when it's going to be. Some think it could be as soon as 5,000 years from now. Some think it's going to be more like 40,000 years from now. But it's looking pretty unlikely that that ice age is going to happen because we've put so much carbon dioxide in the air. It's going to keep the planet warm for at least 100,000 years and probably keep the next ice age from happening unless humans are smart enough to figure out how to take out all the carbon dioxide from the air. Hmm. So have I answered your question enough?
Ray, are you there? Ray's not there anymore, okay. So I guess you have, as much as you're going to answer it. I want to talk about the number of people who died in this when it was horrendous, that, and some of the stories are just so heartbreaking. But considering the coverage that we saw from the air of the complete devastation of so many communities, it strikes me that when we looked at last year and hundreds of people dying in tornadoes, that something must have been working well. Was it that there was, I don't know if you can sense their coming earlier, their tornadoes, or people received earlier warnings, or more people learned what you're supposed to do in a tornado? It was alarming that there was a death toll of 40 or something, but why wasn't it much higher?
That's a good question. Last year, we had 550 deaths during hurricane season, which is really quite extraordinary considering the level of preparedness we have versus previous decades. But yeah, only 40 this time. Part of that was luck. Last year's tornadoes hit some very heavily populated areas, and Friday's tornadoes did not. Last year we had Tuscaloosa, Birmingham, Alabama getting hit, Joplin, Missouri, all fairly densely populated areas. And Friday's tornadoes hit relatively small towns, population 1,000 and 2,000, just not as many people in harm's way. Friday's tornadoes hit regions where people tend to have basements, and that's a big reason why you can survive a tornado if you got a basement. In Joplin, Missouri last year, very few people had basements there, and the death toll was about 158. Just you can't dig a basement, apparently, in the type of rock they have there. So a little bit of luck, a little bit of people having basements, I think, helped, and also, more of the storms hit Friday during daylight hours, and that helped as well. During the previous outbreaks last year, there were a lot more nighttime tornadoes, and the death toll rises during night because people tend to be asleep and don't hear the warnings.
Jeffrey Masters, our guest this hour, co-founder, director of meteorology for Weather Underground. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Susan in Menominee Falls. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Love the show. I came in a little bit later, but I caught the part about you talking about you can't judge wind, how fast the wind is going in a tornado or hurricane. But what about those reality shows, those storm chasers and stuff like that? Granted, they're entertainment in there, but how much is actually real in those things?
Well, those storm chasers are doing what you see. I mean, sometimes there's traffic jams when all the storm chasers converge right on one side of a tornado. There's not enough room on the shoulder for everyone to park their vehicle and, you know, point their cameras and whatever instruments they have at the storm. But we do get a lot of photo coverage and video of tornadoes. We don't get a lot of wind speed measurements because you actually have to have an instrument inside the storm. And we can't remotely measure the winds very well of a tornado. There's only one or two instruments in the world that can do that.
Yeah, Susan, now we can hear you. You were talking over.
They've been shooting these things into the funnel, and I don't know, it reminds me of that movie that was done. and they're saying that they're getting instrument recordings off of the wind speed by doing this. Are they not doing that, or is that just not good enough data for you guys to use?
They're doing it only on very isolated tornadoes. I've only seen data from less than 5 tornadoes, and we get 1,700 tornadoes a year, so it's not enough data to make a judgment about, you know, the bulk of tornadoes and how they might be changing.
How many do we get? What did you say?
We got about 1,700 last year.
Wow, that's a lot of tornadoes, isn't it?
Yeah, that was the second busiest tornado season ever. Behind, in 2004, we had over 1,800.
Whew. Thanks, Susan, for your call. What's it like to... I know that you were, and it changed the course of your work, that you were almost killed flying into a hurricane, Hurricane Hugo. Jeffrey.
So you want to know what's it like flying into a hurricane?
I would like to know that. Yeah.
I always thought it was safer than chasing tornadoes because there are so many things that can harm you, you know, on the ground as far as getting in traffic accidents or lightning or actually, you know, getting caught in the tornado itself. And I used to tell people that the most dangerous part of my day hurricane hunting was driving to the airport because, you know, driving is relatively a dangerous thing to do. But I changed my mind after flying into Hurricane Hugo, which was a Category 5 hurricane when I caught it out beyond the Lesser Antilles Islands in the Atlantic. We have a big four-engine turboprop airplane called a P-3 Orion that would fly into those storms. And we generally, when you try and fly into a hurricane, the object is to fly through the strongest winds at the lowest safe altitude, because you want to sample the storm and figure out how strong it is so you can relay the warnings properly to people. But the trick is always, how do you figure out what the lowest safe altitude is? Generally, in a Category 3 or higher storm, which has winds of 115 miles per hour or greater, you fly in at 10,000 feet so that if you hit a big downdraft, it won't splash you into the ocean. But occasionally, when we're doing a special study to figure out how hurricanes interact with the ocean, we will fly in lower. And Hugo was one of those cases where we decided that we were going to try and fly in lower and take one of these data sets for understanding how they interact with the ocean, which incidentally is critical for trying to improve hurricane forecasts because we don't get much data down near the surface in a hurricane. There just aren't that many instruments down there, and it's a large unknown how that process, the processes that happen down there, influence hurricane intensification. So, in this particular case, back in 1989, we flew in at 1,500 feet, which is very low in an intense hurricane. But the problem was we thought it was a Category 3 hurricane, and we got out there, and it turned out to be a Category 5. Now, when you're flying through extreme turbulence, you can't really do anything once you're in it. You have to gut it out and get all the way through it before you can climb to a higher safe altitude. I wrote this story on my website. It's a pretty well explained and annotated with nice photos that I took of the whole experience. Basically, the 2 minutes of flying we did through the Iowalla Hugo to get to the Calm Eye were the most terrifying 2 minutes of my life. And we hit 5.5 G's of acceleration, had an engine catch on fire, pilot lost control of the aircraft.
Oh.
And fortunately, we were right near the edge of the eye and popped into the Calm Eye, and pilot was able to pull us out of the dive 800 feet above the water.
Oh, my gosh. And so then you did something else with your life, which I can understand.
Well, yeah, we landed, and I was all done flying into hurricanes. And it's time to go back to the safe Midwest where there aren't so many disasters and work on my PhD. So I did that after the hurricane season of 1989, and I have been in Michigan ever since.
Yeah, good for you. Let's go to Scott in Newton. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Jeff. My question involves the sun. Right now we're experiencing the solar maximus, and it also released an unclassed flare last week. Do you feel that had anything to do with all these storms? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
We're still at the early stages of understanding how solar flares and space weather, as we call it, affect the weather. It's not well understood. We do know that when you get the sun putting a lot of ultraviolet light in the upper atmosphere, it does seem to have a larger effect on the weather than we've previously thought, more than you might expect just from the 0.1% change in energy total. So the sun does have an influence on the weather. It's not well understood. We do know that between the peak of the sunspot cycle and the minimum, we do see a change in the global Earth temperature of about a tenth of a degree centigrade, which is not insignificant. And probably the reason we haven't seen a world record Earth temperature over the past year is because we were at the minimum of the sunspot cycle. But now that it's starting to come up, I wouldn't be surprised if next year we could get back to the hottest year on record again.
Next year, 2013.
Yeah, 2013. It's not going to happen this year because we have a cold water episode in the eastern Pacific called La Nina, and that also cools down Earth's temperatures by a few tenths of a degree centigrade.
Ruth Madison, hi.
Hello. I'm wondering about something I heard about tornadoes, that you should crack your windows in order to equalize the temperature. And I'm wondering whether that is still valid. I heard someone said that, no, that was just a wives tale. And then I do have another comment, a question.
The tornado is a region of low pressure, and when it moves overhead, it will reduce the pressure by about 10%. But that's not enough to make your house explode. And in fact, when you open the windows of your house, you give that wind a route to get into your house and start pulling up on your roof. So it's a bad idea to crack your windows.
Oh, okay. And what about the Texas drought, or just the Southwest that we had this last year? Is that on its way to being mediated or not?
I'm sorry, is it what?
Is it being overcome, the drought?
Yeah, you know, they've had an exceptionally wet winter in Texas. The drought's not gone, but it is much better. So that was kind of a surprise because we were predicting a relatively dry winter for Texas. But they still have a long way to go. They have very serious drought situations in large parts of the state, and there are a couple towns that I'm guessing are going to run out of water this summer if we get another hot summer like we had last year.
Thanks, Ruth, for the call. Phil in Crystal Lake, hi.
Hi. I just have a question about what to do in case of a tornado. We live in a ranch house built on a slab, and we're just wondering, should we go in the bathtub or the car in the garage? Or they're just, it's not a very pleasant thing to think about as to where you'd go in a hurry.
No, it's not, but you need to know.
Yeah, right.
The best place for you to go in your house would be an interior room like a bathroom. Getting in the bathtub and covering yourself with a mattress is usually a good idea. If you've got neighbors with a basement, I would prevail upon them to let you use their basement.
Yes, we have asked.
There are these things now you can buy called safe rooms, which are basically these big concrete and steel blocks you can put in your house to shelter in. Wisconsin probably doesn't get enough tornadoes to make it, you know, cost-effective to buy one of those, though.
Oh.
You don't want to go in your vehicle.
Oh.
Vehicles and mobile homes are the largest area of fatalities that you see in tornadoes, and I would stay out of your car in the garage.
How about a closet? Is that good?
Closet's good, too, yep.
Uh-huh.
Just interior room, whatever the most interior room for your house is, because the tornado's got to break through all the outer parts of your house before it can get to the interior, and typically, by then, the tornado will be gone before it has a chance to blow down the interior parts of your house.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Phil. All
right,
you're welcome.
Our number is 800-486-8655. Joe Franklin, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show, as always. Just a little, to start out, we had a little dusting of snow last night here in Milwaukee. I was out shoveling it this morning, and I saw my first robin of the year.
Oh, my.
So spring is on the way. And I was just wondering, what does the National Weather Service predict for this area for the upcoming year? And I guess I'll just take my answer off the air, okay?
Sure. Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, we are expecting much above average temperatures over the next 2 weeks for sure, and also for the next month or two. If you look at the National Weather Service's Climate Prediction Center, or CPC, they have seasonal forecasts going out as long in the future as we have any skill, and they're all showing increased chances of an above-average March and then spring and summer as well. So we'll roll the weather dice and see what comes up, but the odds are stacked in favor of warmer temperatures for the next few months.
Hmm. Well, tomorrow it's supposed to be 50 here. 50. Today it was 20.
That's the March roller coaster for sure.
Oh, yeah. Chris in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Kathleen, love you. Love your show.
Thanks.
And a quick question. Why don't they fly drones into storms? That seems like a job better suited for that.
They are starting to fly drones into storms. Drones are expensive, though. I mean, some of the cheaper ones that they're using are like $10,000 or $14,000 little airplanes. And if you lose one of those, I mean, that's a big loss for some of these not very highly funded research studies. So the answer is they're going to continue to fly drones in, and I expect to see an increase in that. And they'll probably come down in cost and be better able to handle tornado reconnaissance. So 10, 20, 30 years from now, maybe you'll start seeing regular reports from drones and tornadoes. I sure hope so.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Ty in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi. I just want to let you know that I used to live in Galveston, Texas, and Hurricane Hugo was there. I was really young. I came out, and I practically stand on the wind, and I could fall over. I cannot fall over. It was really amazing. Afterwards, my father used on two shrimp boats, and one of them was sunk. And after that, was the highway was like both. House, everything was all over the highway. It was amazing. Mm. I just want to make the comment.
Mm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ty.
Well, yeah, thanks. We used to call that body surfing when I was young and foolish and went out to the beach during Hurricane Gloria in Boston. Yeah, you can just lean right into the wind and it'll hold you up. But it wasn't a good idea the time I did it because I was at the beach and it was safe there, but if you go inland at all, the branches coming off the trees were very dangerous falling around me.
Now, Jeffrey, you went to the ocean during a hurricane? Well, didn't mom say, don't do that?
I was young and indestructible in my teen years, you know.
Oh, my. Don't tell anybody in your family you were doing that.
No.
They would have been mad at you or worried about you. Let's
Absolutely.
Go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. The question is this. A number of years ago, I read an article about a plateau in China, that the environment or the weather conditions, temperatures, etc., eventually would have an effect on the United States. Apparently got into the atmospheres and whatnot. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, the Himalaya Plateau or the Tibetan Plateau is so huge and so high that it dramatically affects weather patterns all over the world. So the jet stream, that high-altitude band of winds that circles the planet, it gets deflected by the Himalayas. And because of that deflection, we have dramatically different weather here than we would have otherwise. So, it's a big influence on our weather. And I might add also that air pollution from China makes it all the way over here and is a major source of pollution here. Up to a third of all the mercury that falls in our waters is coming from China now, from coal-fired power plants. The weather in China is definitely influencing the weather here in North America.
In the United States, even now, is that being used in predictions?
Yeah, sure. I mean, all this information goes into the computer models that we use to forecast the weather.
Hmm.
Okay.
Thanks, John.
Well, that's my question. Thank you.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And when I heard China, I was thinking tomorrow, which I want to tell you about, because Rhonda and I think this is an amazingly fascinating story. Our guest is from the Department of Earth and Environmental Science, Herman Pfefferkorn from Penn, and he has been doing work in China and has found a 300-million-year-old forest preserved by volcanic ash, just as the Roman town of Pompeii was. It was the discovery made near a coal mine in the city of Wuda in China by our guest and Chinese researchers, and it gives us a snapshot of a moment in time. And I don't know if it'll become a tourist attraction at some point or not. It's going to be very much studied. But what a find. It just popped right out at us. And so we said, we got to do a show on this. So tomorrow at 9, we'll hear more about that. Pompeii of trees, the 300-million-year-old forest. Tomorrow at 9 o'clock, tomorrow we'll be speaking with the professor from the University of Pennsylvania who discovered it. All right, more phone calls in a moment. We're looking this hour of the show. We couldn't ignore the massive storms, the tornado outbreak of stunning violence that swept through so much of the country last week, very early in the season, extremely high winds and very destructive tornadoes, and so many of them. And we're asking why. This hour of the show, our guest is Jeffrey Masters, co-founder and director of meteorology at Weather Underground. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Phil is next from Hebron, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, you guys. Doc, a number of years ago, I was able to go to a talk by Dr. Fujita when he came up with the Fujita scale, and he had neat pictures of him hanging from I-beams stuck in the ground and stuff. And now they're using an enhanced Fujita scale. I want to know what the difference is.
Yeah, that's great you got to meet him. He was one of my boyhood idols growing up, actually. He's the only true genius, I'd say, in the meteorological field I've ever met or... He may be one of the more brilliant meteorologists of all time. He developed these two scales which rate damage from tornadoes based on various factors as far as the construction and how it holds up under the tornado's winds. And, yeah, building practices have changed since he originally developed the Fujita scale. And we took an account in... We took into account these changes in building practices since the 1960s. We're building buildings a little bit better, and we added more ways to figure out how the tornado is doing damage. For instance, the enhanced scale's got what happens when a tree gets its bark peeled, I mean, what kind of winds are that, or if a car gets tossed, how strong a wind happens to be for that to happen. So a lot more ways to figure out what the tornado's wind speeds are based on damage, and some changes based on construction practices because of findings we've made in some of these wind tunnels where we actually put a building in a wind tunnel, crank up the wind and throw boards up and watch what they do to buildings. So it's just an enhancement, just like the name would suggest, based on more information.
Thanks, Phil, for the call. Kelly in Bayfield, hi.
Hi. I just had a quick question. Did the Great Lakes affect tornado formation?
Oh, absolutely. The Great Lakes tend to suppress tornado formation because it makes the air more stable. Whenever you have cool air near the surface, that's less conducive for tornadoes, and the Great Lakes are certainly a big pool of cool water that cool the air around them. So you see far fewer tornadoes right around the edges of the Great Lakes than you see in the interior of states like Wisconsin and Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Say the city of Milwaukee, in my many years living here, I remember once there was a tornado. It wasn't real close to Lake Michigan, but it was in Milwaukee. I believe it was a factual sighting. But you just don't hear about tornadoes in this city.
No, not too much.
The lake is right there. Thank goodness for the lake, huh? Thank you, Kelly, for your call. John in Green Bay, hi.
Hi. This might be a better question for another show, but will you briefly describe the condition or the state of the atmosphere in relation to mercury and pollution in our country, I guess all over?
The mercury that goes up into the air in our country primarily comes from a couple sources. Number one is coal-fired power plants. Coal's got mercury in it. You burn the coal, it releases mercury into the air. And the other is incinerators. When you take trash and people throw their batteries in there and you burn the batteries, then mercury goes in the air. Mercury is a huge problem right now. We got mercury advisories. I know in the state of Michigan, I don't know in Wisconsin, you can't really eat the fish from the inland lakes caught here if you're a pregnant woman, and it's advisable not to eat too much if you're somebody else. And the problem has not gotten that much better compared to some of the other air pollution problems that we've solved or gotten better in the last few decades. So a lot of work to be done. The Obama administration has just proposed new mercury rules that will help immensely, and I would greatly support those efforts to increase the regulation of mercury in the air, because it's a very toxic substance. There's evidence it's causing a lot of brain damage in kids, so we need to get this under control better.
Thanks.
Thank you, John. A couple lines are open. They've been really crowded. 800-486-8655, our number. Rod is next. Hi, Rod.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I was going to say Joy. I keep your
it's
name.
It's Kathleen.
Kathleen.
Right.
My memory's kind of screwed up. Anyhow, first of all, I have two questions. About referring to the safety spots, if you have a basement, I was always told the southwest corner. I was just wondering if I was correct on that. And also, I don't know if you ever listen to that Coast to Coast program. It's on at night sometimes, AM. And they had two physicists on last night. They're talking about the electric universe, that the sun is not what we previously were thinking. The fusion, they were thinking it was electrical charge. And there's charges and discharges taking place all the time. So, in other words, how is it, does this affect, like there's an asteroid supposed to be coming in now, and they said that it's supposed to pass within 16,000 miles of the Earth. Now, when these come in, if there's a discharge, does that heat up even, you know, space, and can that affect our planet, our temperatures on Earth?
I guess. Okay. I'll answer both questions. Number one, we're not really sure what part of your basement is the safest. It depends on the construction. Yeah, for a long time it was theorized the southwest would be best, because tornadoes usually come from the southwest. So if you're right there in the corner, then it makes sense that all the debris will kind of get pushed over to the rest of the basement and maybe not fall so much in the southwest corner. But the last study I saw on the subject showed it doesn't really matter where in the basement you are. The entire basement is roughly equal in its safety. So, you know, look around your basement, try and find maybe a heavy table to get under or something. That's your best bet.
Okay.
And as far as the sun and the electrical output of it, again, we don't really understand very well how the sun's output interacts with the weather, and I'm just going to have to say, well, listen to Coast to Coast. They're an entertaining show. There's certainly some provocative information there, and really the science isn't strong enough to say one way or the other how the sun is affecting it that greatly.
Thanks, Rod. David in Dubuque. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a question for Jeff. I got to get his thoughts on this. Is there a relationship with this, with the Arctic ice melting and glaciers melting all over the world, with what's going on with these recent tornadoes? And in Russia this winter, they had such a terrible cold winter over there. Do you see any relationship there?
I do see a potential relationship. Certainly when you melt huge areas of the Arctic sea ice like we've been doing, I mean, an area about 40% of the size of the contiguous U.S. has been melting out each summer. When you expose that amount of water, you're going to sharply increase the amount of heat and moisture in the Arctic, and that's going to affect the jet stream, which controls our weather. And there have been three studies published now in the last couple of years, which is linking loss of Arctic sea ice to changes in the jet stream, and in particular, making it more likely that you get some of these big Arctic cold blasts that go over Europe and over the eastern part of North America. We didn't get one this year in North America. Europe did. So there's a big problem understanding why the weather has been so crazy lately. I mean, the last six winters in the U.S., we saw the most extreme configuration of the jet stream, two in the warm side and then two on the cold side. This year was one of the warm ones. Why has it been so nuts on both sides? Well, I wouldn't be surprised if we are seeing some influence from Arctic sea ice, but the research on this is just beginning, and we don't really understand yet what's going on.
And next year is a warm one too, Jeffrey?
Yeah, I don't know. Roll the dice. we'll see what happens next winter.
Yeah. Thanks, David, for your call. AJ in Madison. Hi. Hello, AJ. Oh, I'm sorry. It's not AJ. It's Dave from Fond du Lac. I'm way off here. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Wondering if other countries are afflicted with tornadoes. Take my answer.
Well, I'm glad you asked that. I was thinking that, too.
The U.S. is number one. Something like two-thirds of all the intense tornadoes observed worldwide occur in the U.S. But there are other countries that get bad tornadoes. In fact, the deadliest tornado in history occurred in Bangladesh. They had over 1,000 people die in a tornado a few years ago. Argentina gets tornadoes as well. And there are weak tornadoes in the United Kingdom and other parts of Europe as well.
And why is the U.S. number one?
The U.S. is number one because you've got a source of very warm, moist air in the Gulf of Mexico and a source of very cold, dry air up in Canada that can collide and cause instability. And on top of that, you can also get very strong jet stream winds. There's no other place on the planet where you've got those three things that all come into juxtaposition like they can in the U.S.
AJ in Madison now. Hi, AJ.
Hi there. My question is for your guest. He referred to earlier meteorologists typically only have about a week or 2 weeks where they can kind of accurately predict the weather. I'm kind of wondering if he has any knowledge on how much longer will it be before they can accurately predict, you know, a lot longer, possibly with supercomputers or these new technologies that they are coming out with.
Yeah, certainly computer technology is helping with weather forecasts. I mean, the accuracy of a four-day forecast now is the same as it was for a three-day forecast 10 years ago, and a large part of that is because of improved computer power. But there's a limit to how far we can go. The atmosphere is just fundamentally chaotic, and you can't really predict with any skill. I'm guessing the limit's going to be 10 days. I mean, maybe 50 years from now, our 10-day forecasts will be what they are for five-day forecasts now, and that's going to be the limit. You just won't be able to get better than that just because of chaos.
Okay. I guess the reason why I was wondering is because if we could accurately predict farther out, we would be able to help prepare for, you know, people who go through hurricanes and the like. So.
Sure. Thanks, AJ.
A large part of the answer will depend on how well we observe the atmosphere, too. In order to make a good prediction, you have to know what is the atmosphere doing right now. You need to have a lot of data points. You need to have information from satellites, from ground-based networks. That will improve, but you can't cover every part of the globe with an observing unit, so that will limit us as well.
Cass in Appleton. Hi.
Hi. My question is, in China, they shoot something into the clouds to make it rain in certain areas, and I want to know if that actually would affect it if we were to do it here in the United States when there's a tornado being formed. I mean, if all the clouds are getting too low or something like that, if you were to disrupt that.
Yeah, it's controversial. We do know that you can seed clouds and make rain, but it's uncertain whether, if you do that for a whole month, whether it actually, for the whole month, has a noticeable impact, or maybe you actually end up taking away rain from somebody else. So a lot of controversy. There's a lot of lawsuits that have been filed about weather modification, and it's an area of research that's ongoing, and it's a tricky area of research because you are potentially impacting somebody else's weather, and they can sue you.
Right. All right. Thanks, Cass. Peter in Stoughton. Hi.
Morning. I was wondering if, as a resident of Wisconsin here, if I should be upping the insurance on my home. Mm-hmm. Are the insurance companies changing their actuarial observations on these things? Or what do you recommend, Mr. Insurance Expert?
Yeah, well, insurance companies are jacking their rates this year as a result of the tornadoes we just experienced and the tornadoes last year. And if you look at insured damages over the past few decades, they've been doubling about every 10 years due to weather disasters. So, yeah, insurance rates are going to go up. I would expect they're going to continue to go up. It's controversial whether those rates are increasing because of climate change making disasters more likely. We do know that there's more people, the population's expanding, and people are getting wealthier. They're buying more stuff, so more people with more stuff are getting hit by tornadoes and floods and so on, and that causes more insured damages and higher insurance rates. I would expect that we will see an even sharper increase in insured damages due to climate change as we move forward into the next few decades.
We're out of time. Jeffrey, what's your website?
The website is weatherunderground.com or wonderground.com, and I write a daily blog on there talking about the weather.
All right. Weatherunderground.com. Thank you, Jeffrey.
All right, you're welcome.
Thanks,
Kathleen. I always enjoy talking about the weather.
Yeah, you're a wealth of information. Jeffrey Masters, co-founder and director of meteorology for Weather Underground. And there's this, all of your interest in this. We had a ton of phone calls. You may want to go to that website. Tomorrow at 9 o'clock, we're going to do this Chinese forest story, which just, you know, knocked us out. 300-million-year-old forest preserved by volcanic ash, just as the Roman town of Pompeii was. We'll talk with the discoverer from the University of Pennsylvania. And then we're going to do something slightly different at 10 o'clock tomorrow. There's been talk about Scottish secession, and we're going to talk about that. It's a big thing in Scotland, so join us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour.